Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Glad you tuned in and that you're listening to NPR this morning. If I tell you that this is a show about teaching women how to find and ignite our power, you might think my guest is a corporate CEO, a prof at a business school, even a high-octane consultant. I'm pretty sure you're not expecting Kasia Urbaniak, and I'll let you guess why for a few moments. Let's just say that Kasia exercises power in ways that will be new and persuasive to many of us. She writes in her new book, "Power isn't a mood, an outfit, a moment, or a pose. It's the ability to access your deepest desires, express them fully, and use them to influence other people and the world at large." Kasia Urbaniak's new book is titled Unbound, A Women's Guide to Power. Kasia, welcome. I've been really eager to talk to you about the book, so I'm glad you're with us today.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
So I have been intentionally a bit mysterious about your life and your professional experience. Let's start with the training that you undertook in martial arts and Chinese medicine, studying to be a Taoist nun. Tell me about that and you know, what drew you to the practices of Taoism?
One of the things that I discovered very early on in my spiritual path is that I had a deep appreciation for what was practical and applicable. Mm-hmm. What was easy to understand as useful in everyday life. There was there's a beautiful way in which Taoism, as an Eastern philosophy and as a path of evolution, really has you see what's happening in the moment. And in Taoist studies, you don't even really get to learn some of the more metaphysical stuff unless you know how to heal people, defend yourself, martial arts, Chinese medicine, those things, right? The contemplative practices start early, but they don't advance. It's not theory in the sense of, you know, there is, you know, a bunch of rites and rituals where you have to have blind faith. You learn how to be a good, healthy person first. And I really appreciated that. I felt like that was that being practical is a really compassionate thing to do for human beings. And it was in contrast to some of the very like ideological, intellectual, theoretical, or kind of other top-heavy, mental first, not practical things I was facing.
You wrote about working with one of the most respected abbots in China, and you say that although she was quite a diminutive woman, you were blown away by her physical presence. This sounds like such an extraordinary environment to step into. Can you tell us a bit about the practices that you learned with her and why she remains, it sounds like, so deeply influential in the life that you're leading now? What'd she give you?
Well, absolutely. I could spend a few hours just talking about the experience of training to be accepted to be able to go over there. Uh-huh. And the experience of being there. I mean, just picture, I'm on a mountaintop and the clouds are a sea right below me while I'm practicing Qigong, while I'm practicing these practices that are geared towards the specialty in that place and the field, the focus of study was manipulation of the female hormone system. So it was very much the stuff specifically for women that's conventionally left out of what is most popular about Taoism. And I can't, it's difficult for me to talk about my Taoist training without mentioning the other profession that I had, the other part of my path, which was a professional dominatrix in New York City. And what, the stark contrast between those two things and having found an overlap was my access point to this whole new understanding of power. So just to, you know, I am 1 month on a mountaintop in China studying with Taoist nuns, this particular teacher, these celibate nuns that are so rooted that when you take a look at one of them, it feels like you're seeing the top 8% of their bodies. Like they're so deeply rooted into the ground. You couldn't push them over. You couldn't even have the thought. Nothing like flighty or light or vapid or airy about them, just like rooted. And next month I'm in a New York City BDSM dungeon being a 20-year-old dominating 50-year-old corporate executives in New York. And the meeting place between those, both the way the synergy between those two paths had everything to do with this absolutely, I mean, I was blessed with the opportunity to both have witnessed, practice, and train my attention to a point where my sensitivity and awareness was so intense that I could see these patterns in male and female behavior. I could see the patterns in what the architecture of power that's underneath every single conversation. The other thing was that a lot of the training had to do with allowing energy to circulate in the pelvic area, releasing a lot of the held trauma in the sexual organs. And it was so, what was also so incredible to me is that this celibate sect was more, how shall I say, sexually integrated and powerful than some of the most powerful women I knew back home.
So I don't want to move away too quickly from the contrast here, though, because, I mean, and you're emphasizing that. I think, and maybe this is a misunderstanding of what you're doing as you're learning Taoism, and you're in this space on this mountain where the clouds, you know, are obscuring the ground. I think of that as a very heady, intellectual-centered kind of experience. And then I think of the contrast of, as you've noted, having come from these experiences in the dungeon. I think of that as a very physical, and this is probably a misapprehension, non-intellectual kind of practice. And so, you know, as I tried to put the pieces of your life together, I saw this as either ends of the spectrum. And what I think you're telling me is that is not, that really does not turn out to be true.
In some cases, they are opposite ends of the spectrum, but it's their unexpected meeting point that dominates my experience. So, like, both of those experiences are very much in the body. One, because Taoist training, it has everything to do with being rooted and grounded in the body. And here's the thing about working as a dominatrix in a New York City dungeon. I don't know if you know this, but in those circumstances, I'm not a sex worker in the traditional sense. There's no sex exchange. The entire session is composed of speaking and sometimes some tying up of the other person, but mostly it's attention and talking. It's psychology. So in that sense, none of the things I'm saying are true in that environment. It's all imagination. It's all situation, circumstance. In some ways, that makes the Taoist experience even more grounded, even more in the body. But what the way they cross-pollinate, the way they inform each other, has everything to do with the absolute power and magic of attention and where attention is.
You know, I read about that, and I want to talk about that. But it is so interesting to hear you say none of the things that happen in the dungeons are true. I think we may be people like myself who have never, you know, experienced that, seen it in person, think of it as kind of the ultimate physical experience, because I think of you as administering some kind of pain. And I don't think of that as imaginary and so rooted in imagination. I think of that as a consummately physical experience. No?
Well, no, not really. I mean, it depends. Like, you can talk to a different dominatrix and have a different. You know, we have specialties and skill sets, and the percentage of masochists, people who just wanted pain, that came to me was maybe like 5 or 10%.
Really?
Most of it was role play. Most of it was psychological domination. Most of it was emotional and psychological overpowering. It was language-based. That was my specialty. And you know, I don't know, I'm sure they don't really have statistics on this industry-wide. So I can't tell whether it's because that desire for an acutely physical experience versus an emotionally powerful and psychologically overpowering one. I don't know if it's because those it's less common than people think, or if it's just who I attracted, who came to me, who repeatedly would come back. But that's the field I explored. What I explored was the ability to hold somebody in my attention and have them feel the weight of my power, feel the weight. And, you know, like I could have gotten away with kind of faking it. And instead, I became obsessed with this idea of like, what does it take to actually have this person feel either pinned or held just by virtue of how I am and what I say? And I started to geek out on it. I read everything about it and everything about any tangential path from dog training to psychological texts. But the thing that ended up informing me the most was the ability to read the body that I got from my Taoist training. So in martial arts, you know, the training of attention has a lot to do with knowing when somebody's going to go in for a hit, mm-hmm. being able to feel that the shoulder is going to contract before it does, being able to feel the intention. In Chinese medicine, a lot of the diagnosis is not blood tests. A lot of the diagnosis, or at least what they teach you when you first enter this kind of environment, has to do with being able to read the body, mm-hmm. being able to look and use your attention so acutely that you notice things. Right, the way that, like, you know, a Western medical doctor might, through sheer experience, see patterns in how people show up versus the conditions that they come with. So that level of attention made it really, 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 really informed how I went about doing this work that I started doing just for money, so I could travel around the world and study these fantastical, phenomenal things. So, you know, one of the things that became apparent to me pretty quickly was the degree to which a woman, because first it was me and then it was the dominatrixes I trained, hesitate to place their attention fully on a man. And I'm not talking about holding space and being caring and nurturing. I'm talking about placing attention on them to the point that their physical body can feel it, and leading them with questions, noticing things, labeling things. Your chest just sank. Are you sad? You seem all of the sudden drowning in grief, or all of the sudden you seem quite rebellious. That chin just popped up, right? This is in the context of a BDSM dungeon, but I started noticing that women everywhere had this hesitation, this fear of men that had it so that the communication and the language and the attention became very self-referential, very submissive. So in an office meeting, you know, a woman in a meeting is surrounded by her colleagues. And when she speaks an idea, the radius of her attention is 2 feet and she's mumbling it into her cup. And she's saying, I think, mm-hmm. I have an idea, I suggest, I feel, right? Whereas then the, you know, here we have, this is where it becomes very, very crucial and essential. In that environment, human beings are still animals and we still look for a leader. And the secret defining characteristic of whether somebody's in charge or not has to do with where their attention is. So somebody whose attention's on themselves is signaling to the rest of the herd, to the rest of the pack, that they're another one of the submissives. And the person, and this is not a permanent thing, right? If I'm stepping up to lead the conversation, I am temporarily the leader of the pack. What do I need to do? I need to make sure that I put my attention out on the entire pack. Now, the woman who's been trained through her conditioning, as we all have, to have a smaller radius of attention and make everything self-referential. For example, we're questioned, we're put on the spot. Somebody makes an inappropriate sexual advance. What do? Did I give the wrong signal? What did I do? The internal monologue, the attention buries more deeply inward until we're frozen, paralyzed, can't get out. Right? A woman in a meeting, right? She mumbles her idea into her cup. Her radius of attention is quite small. People hear the idea, but they don't register it as a mandate. They don't see her as the person who's in charge for that moment. So you can witness this. We've done extensive studies of this. The bodies in the room are in what we call still a dominant or middle state. And it isn't until somebody else restates the idea from a dominant state of attention that the bodies shift and it feels like the goal's been landed. And everybody remembers, usually it's a guy. And everybody remembers that guy delivered that idea because he delivered it in a dominant state of attention, which he's been trained to use since he was in diapers. So, you know, anytime a woman has gone into a situation where she's looking for an apology, walks out apologizing herself, she goes into to ask for something she wants. She freezes before she gets there. Unexpectedly freezes, then beats herself up for not standing in her truth, speaking her voice, and being in her power. These mechanics of attention are something that all of us have been trained to do in our gendered ways since we're born and identified as male and female. You can even see it, how it plays out later on. The way that we talk about politicians, the way we talk about celebrities, if it's a woman, we talk about how she is, her being. Mm-hmm. If we talk about men, he may be, he may be kind of a mess, or he may be kind of a bully, but look what he's achieved. And this difference between putting attention on a woman's being, how she is she a slut? Is she a prude? Is she a monster? Is she versus a man's agency is how we end up training the attention of boys and girls. The moment you say, look, Mary's wearing such a pretty dress. Look at her lovely demeanor. And look at Billy. He scored a goal. He got into a fight, right? The moment we start doing that, what we as young people start to learn very quickly is that we get rewarded with attention, positive or negative, for the moments where boys' attention's out, their attention's out in a dominant state of attention, doing stuff in a state of agency. And women, girls, are rewarded with attention, positive or negative, when their attention's on themselves. So it becomes a default habit. And it ends up explaining so many of the absolutely impossible things to explain. There are so many men who are not overtly sexist. They're just carrying this particular gendered patterning. So they'll overstep. They'll manterrupt. They'll even get themselves into situations where they don't know they're being inappropriate, and then they're sexual harassers. I'm not saying that there aren't predators, there aren't messed up people out there using whatever status or tactics they can in order to take advantage of each other, but there's this whole huge middle ground of clumsy people not knowing, men in particular, not knowing what they're doing as they're doing the things that will, because of our different conditioning in terms of patterns of attention, will be devastating. Because it's not a small thing to freeze. It's not a small thing, because 99% of the time it might not matter. But that one time, the job's given away. The whole company is going in the wrong direction. His hand is up your skirt. You lose custody of the kids. Sometimes it happens in that one moment. So, I'm on a mission to get women to see how actually easy to break these gendered patternings are. They're easy to break because it's just a game of learning to play with your attention in a way that we're born knowing how to do before we're conditioned. Children know how to do this. They know how to do this. They're flawless in it. They ask questions. They know how to put their attention in. They know how to put their attention out. They know how to ask for what they want shamelessly, even if it's ridiculous or impossible. And it takes so much heavy conditioning for a woman to freeze inside of herself, to get stuck inside of herself, to feel like she's living life behind a wall of glass. Even if she's a badass, even if she's got the career, the life, the kids, the money, everything, even if she's got it all, there's this incredible burden and oppressive weight. And a lot of it can be witnessed in this very simple architecture of attention.
So let's do this, because you've written really persuasively of how to direct attention in and out and how to calibrate it. Will you describe what it means, because I don't want our listeners to think when you're directing your attention out, you are dominating the room and you are doing it with a louder voice, you know, and all maybe the kinds of things that we would normally think of owning a room. This is much more nuanced than that. So describe what you're doing when you're directing your attention out as a woman and you're achieving some of the things that you describe that kind of come naturally to men. How are you doing this?
Well, there's two ways of talking about this. One is that if your attention is out and you're speaking instructions or labeling what you see in this dominant state of attention. You can do it soft and flirty, feminine. You can do it loud and masculine. You can do it in any kind, like the quality of it is not what matters. But I think for the listeners, it might be helpful to understand calibration by understanding what happens when you try to flip a power dynamic, when you try to go from the submissive state to the dominant state, because both are great, both are persuasive, both are influential. But when you get stuck in one, it's natural. Like you and I we're moving the attention back and forth. I'm listening to what you're saying. My attention's on you, right? We're flipping back and forth. It makes conversation possible. It makes everything possible. It makes collaboration possible. It makes sex possible. Listen, receive, you know, speak, give, so let me take you to the academy, my school, Kasia Urbaniak's lecture hall. I'm teaching women this simple first tip on breaking the freeze. 600 women in a hall. And I tell them, I'm going to do this thing right now where I'm going to put you on the spot. I'm going to ask you an inappropriate question. You're going to feel my attention go on you as I ask you this inappropriate question. Your job is to not answer the question. And let me tell you, this assortment of uncomfortable questions ranges from something as simple as, what do you do for a living? How are you? To the very, very, very uncomfortable, did you get raped as a child? Do you like extreme sex, right? So most of the freezing that happens in that room happens over some of the questions, most simple questions. It doesn't matter if the question is that inappropriate or not. Can I have your phone number, right? So when I'm shooting these questions out to individual women in the audience, their only job is to not answer the question. I go up to the first one, she answers the question. I go up to the second one. She answers the question. And I give them the instruction. Ask me a question back. Why do you want to know? Why do you ask? Are you taking a poll on who's married or not? Are you looking for a babysitter? Right? Like just whatever the question is, you know, did you get that job because you're pretty? Are you taking a survey on beautiful women? Are you looking for a job? Whatever. But the point is to not answer the question, because how many times has a woman been in a situation where she feels like she has to answer, justify, and validate?
That's all the time.
Submissive default state. Yeah. Even a woman with a high self-esteem, high confidence, right? But it doesn't even occur to us to question the questioner because of the default state of attention. Sometimes we'll bristle. So this is what it looks like to flip the power dynamic, right? So I tell them, ask me a question. So the first one that actually doesn't answer the question, doesn't totally freeze, but breaks the freeze really quickly. I ask her, have you ever had a threesome? And she goes, who the hell do you think you are? And the whole room roars. Everyone's laughing. Yay, she did it. She did it. She did it. She flipped the power dynamic. However, that was uncalibrated. That was uncalibrated because that's the first one. It takes five or six before the energy of the question and how insulting or not insulting it is and the playback, right, the volley, matches and is what we call calibrated. So, you know, you can find yourself in a situation where, you know, some women have literally said something like, you know, the scenario, business trip, hotel bar, colleague, maybe we should, or boss, maybe we should continue this up in my hotel room, right? Instead of freezing, saying, well, I don't know if that's appropriate. But what is it that we could do in your hotel room that we can't do right here,
right?
Or role plays where it's like, it sounds like you'll give me the promotion if you and I have a sexual relationship. Is that true? You have to calibrate it to the particular situation, but knowing that you can flip that dynamic, right? This is not what I'm talking about. Going from the submissive, surrendered state where somebody is putting attention on you and it starts to feel bad, moving the attention and flipping the power dynamic, it's not brutal. In these cases, it's exactly the thing that can restore your agency.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it with grace and charm. It restores your agency, changes your biochemistry, so that if you are even in a situation where it's dangerous, you can get out. But if you're frozen, you're unlikely to. You're unlikely to make for the door. You're unlikely to.
You're listening to a conversation with Kasia Urbaniak about her new book, Unbound, A Woman's Guide to Power. You heard us talking at the beginning of the discussion about Kasia financing her study as a Taoist nun with a Chinese abbot by doing some work in BDSM dungeons in New York and beginning to discover that there are meeting places and understandings, right, to be appreciated about power and agency in both of those experiences, that those experiences informed a lot of what we're talking about this morning. As you listen to the discussion, I'd love to have you weigh in on Twitter. Can you articulate, as a woman, what you want in your professional and personal life? How accomplished are you at asking for what you want? This is something I'm going to talk about with Kasia here in just a moment, but I'd love for you to think about that and weigh in. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. So we've talked a bit about some of these exercises on attention in and out, Kasia. I do want to talk about some of the exercises that you do on showing women how to ask for what they want. And I have to say, this was pretty revelatory for me, because your chapter on the power of asking says women are taught early that asking creates debt, that it automatically leads to a quid pro quo. And then you add, that's just wrong. I have to say, I have believed that throughout my professional career. And probably, you know, I probably practice that in my personal life as well. Now, is this something that's a cluster of personality traits that kind of make me who I am? Or is this something that we women learn early on and practice through a lot of our professional and personal lives?
I think this is something that's learned. I don't think it's a personality trait at all. I'd be willing to wager that the women who are writing on Twitter are confessing that asking for something, especially if they're not sure they're going to get a yes, is an absolute nightmare. And if we're not getting no's, if we're not getting people saying no, then we're not asking far enough. Then we're not occupying all of the potential space that's already agreed upon in terms of what we can have, the resources we need to do our jobs, the things we simply want. It's like, you know, negotiation, collaboration, and intimacy begins at no, and most of us aren't living big enough to even reach anywhere near that no. Asking, you know, it's like we've got this really unfortunate double bind. In terms of our human history, the idea that women can own property and are not property is actually quite new. And I think we forget that. We forget that it's not just new, it's not everywhere on the planet, and it's pretty new. And as women are going from being property, right, being a thing, to having agency, we get caught in this terrible spot in the middle. This is this terrible spot in the middle. If you are weak and needy, asking is a sign that you're lacking. You can't do something for yourself. Mm-hmm. So now women are supposed to be independent, super powerful, and be able to do everything themselves. All of the most competent human beings I know are women, many of them single mothers. The sign that asking for something makes you weak is one side, but we also have the other side. If we ask, command, demand for something from a position that's not weak, we are in danger of seeming bossy, domineering, too much, overpowering. And in between too much and too little, there's no space. This is what defines a lot of contemporary Western women's lives, the tightrope between too much and not enough. You're too intellectual until you're dumb. You are too hardworking until you're lazy. You're too concerned with your family until you're neglectful of your family. There's no room to breathe in between. So there's no room to breathe in between this former role of being the submissive housewife to being too much, too demanding, too overpowering. This means that it becomes incredibly difficult psychologically to imagine that asking isn't anything other than an indication of how we're wrong. We are bossy or we are needy. When asking doesn't really have anything to do with being. When somebody says no to your request, they're saying no to your request, not to you. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with your being. Now, what happens in actual life is when you make a powerful ask, you are inviting somebody into a powerful role. I see actually a lot of marriages fail between men and women when women are so competent, they render their partner useless. They don't ask for anything, oftentimes out of kindness, until it becomes frustration and resignation. And the partner doesn't have a chance to step into a phenomenal role. So when I say asking doesn't create debt, asking creates a new role. When you ask for very little, the role you're giving the person is a very small role. My husband is asked the kinds of requests you would ask only a worm, a parasite, somebody not competent, somebody not powerful. Making a request, asking, can also be a way to bring a friend in closer. The weight and the importance of people in our lives is communicated through our willingness to invite them into our needs, into our desires, into our visions. And how close we bring them, how essential we make them, is communicated through an ask. So inadvertently, when women are afraid of showing up a certain way, of how they look mm-hmm. when they make requests, they're also rendering everyone in their life less useful, useless. Very, very quickly, the powerful, independent woman ends up being surrounded by people who need her, not people who feed her, is drained, frustrated, angry. And even though she's accomplished in her own mind, even though she's accomplished in the sphere she's in, she's exhausted and nowhere near what she could be if she was incredibly well-nurtured, supported, well-resourced. And building that community has a lot to do, and building that support network has a lot to do with being able to make compelling, 100% life-filled requests.
How, Kasha, how much do you think of this is about how risky women think it is to show vulnerability in spaces where, you know, the belief is that if I show that, it will define me as what kind of what you've described, needy, uncertain, unsure about what I think. I think we get a lot of messaging that there is a great risk attached to showing vulnerability, especially in the professional world.
Absolutely. But I would go so far as to define that there is a fear of vulnerability in both directions, in both seeming. There's something vulnerable even about admitting that you think you're phenomenal and fantastic.
Yeah, for sure. Like,
we are taught to be scared and freaked out of both seeming like too much and seeming like too little. So it's like, yeah, absolutely, fear of vulnerability. But I hear that and I'm like, well, men have a fear of vulnerability too. Mm-hmm. What men don't have, where it's different, is when it comes to singing your own praises, celebrating yourself. I tell a friend, she has a nice sweater. She goes, oh, this old thing? You know, I think it's even more taboo than it is to be vulnerable than to say, I am phenomenal. Hi, I'm on this show and I'm giving an interview. I'm a published author. As of March, I am a published author. I worked on this book for 7 years and it came out of a laboratory environment with women using these techniques that work. I am so proud of myself. Like that is even more taboo. That is even more taboo. So the common denominator here is when we learn how to work with attention when it comes to power dynamics, because the common denominator between being afraid of appearing like too much or too little, we're obsessed with being and not doing, and both are important. It's when you get stuck in one that you have a problem. And when you understand how to work with attention and these power dynamics, it doesn't matter if you're temporarily appearing to be weak or temporarily appearing to be full of yourself. Because when you know how to use these attention dynamics, you can get yourself out of it very quickly. You can keep track of the embodied conversation that's happening and change, you know, pivot, see how your communications are landing. And that more valuable than knowing how to stay out of trouble, how to keep from being misunderstood, is the ability to get out of trouble and make messes and clean them up, have the wrong impression for a moment, and then see what's happened in the room and pivot. That is powerful, because then you don't have to be afraid.
I was curious as I finished the book whether there are women in the public sphere. Scientists, celebrities, politicians who you observe, who you don't know, but whom you observe and say, boy, they really understand that attention in and out and how to work their power. Yeah?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'll give you two examples really quickly.
Good.
I mean, I could give you tons, but let's start with two. Watch Oprah give an interview. Watch her on camera. The way she uses her dominant state of attention out, she is holding her interviewee or interviewees in the tractor beam of her attention. She is guiding them through a process of questions, and she does not drop them for a second. She does not put her attention on herself and drop them for a millisecond, not even a flicker of an eye, not even an eye blink. You want to see what power can look like? Watch that. You wouldn't call that domineering.
Right.
You wouldn't call that bossy or bullying. It's an impeccable use of the dominant state of attention. She's not holding space. That is too neutral. She's not holding space. She is definitely leading her witnesses, but she's holding them and allowing for what needs to come up from their side to come up, picking up the ball and advancing it further. She never drops them. Submissive state of attention. Actually, I can think of two people. One is just from photographs. Marilyn Monroe, mm-hmm. Powerful woman. If you look at her eyes, if you look at her face, when somebody's in a dominant state of attention, their eyes look like they're looking out. When somebody's in a submissive, surrendered state of attention, their eyes look like you could fall into them. It's magnetic, not radiant. It draws you in. Marilyn Monroe and her whole demeanor pulls you in. Somebody alive today, Brené Brown, when she speaks about her personal experiences in her TED Talk, in her speeches, she's taking you through her own process. And when she does, you feel yourself falling into her story. Also, powerful, soft, Marilyn Monroe, Oprah, Brené Brown, three examples. You wouldn't think of Brené Brown or Marilyn Monroe as slaves.
No, yeah.
Or disempowered doormats. And you wouldn't think of Oprah as a dominatrix bully, right? And yet they're exhibiting a really facile use of those particular states of attention.
I have to say one thing about Oprah, too, that I find really extraordinary. You are right. Whether she is leading the interview, as we saw with, Harry and Meghan recently, or whether she is the one on the receiving end of the questions, I think of it as a serene, calm, focused center to her being that I trust wherever she is going to take it or lead it or, you know, receive it. That's a lot of experience, I think. It'd be very interesting to hear what she thinks about what you're saying about attention in and out. Whether she practices it, knowing how she's practicing it. What do you think?
When you say calm, there's one thing that I keep wanting to add, which is whether you're using your attention or out, definitely having a relatively calm nervous system is crucial and essential. Mm-hmm. The deeper that your grounding and calm can go, the more space there is for influence. And she's a really good example of that. However, what can also help is understanding how to put your attention in or put your attention out. Someone who's very nervous, someone who's scared of a particular encounter, you put your attention all the way out. You hit a flow state where self-consciousness becomes impossible. You know, when they give you that kind of silly advice when you're about to give a speech, they're like, picture the audience naked.
No, I've never gotten that.
No, but the construction, the idea behind it, the reason why it might work for some people is you have to put your attention out in order to imagine 500 people make it. You really do. You have to invest. And once you see them, you forget yourself. And when you see them, then you're speaking to them, speaking to their body, speaking to where they're at, able to meet whatever comes up, right? So that's the beauty of the attention out space. It erases self-consciousness and fear. Same thing if you're able to put your attention wholly in when you're speaking from a place of ultimate truth. It's scary to get there. It can be really scary to be vulnerable. But once you start, once you get over that initial cringe, there's nothing more purifying and empowering.
Kasha, I've loved the conversation. Wow. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kasha Urbaniak's book is called Unbound: A Women's Guide to Power.